question to our matinee performance of the second of the Cavisham lectures, which is on the architect Ninian Comber.
Now, I want to acknowledge my sources. This wonderful book, which I borrowed off Father Carl, produced by Anthony Simonson, who bizarrely is a Jesuit priest, and who clearly regrets many recent changes in Catholic liturgy and architecture. And he, in association with Stephen Bucknell, who's the descendant of one of the Bucknells who worked in close tandem with Ninian Comber, produced this amazing book, beautiful book, except all the plates are in black and white, probably because, well, Comber shot many of the photographs himself. He liked them to be photographed at churches in the early morning or late evening, and probably the expense of doing colour plates are very too big, but as we're finding out, we have some gorgeous images to show you today. Ninian Comber was born in Aberdeen in 1864, the eldest son and fourth child of the seven children of the Reverend John Comber, an advanced Anglo-Catholic ordained into the Scottish Episcopal Church. In his childhood, he would have met many prominent members of the movement as they passed through the vicarage. Apparently, the visitor's book was something of a roll call of northern members of the Anglo-Catholic movement. And John Mason Neal, the famous hymn writer, was one of Ninian Comber's godparents. And that's one of the things we have to understand about this man. He was a true believer in the cause right from the go-get. He left school at the age of 16 to draw at the Aberdeen School of Art, and then he went on to study for a term at the Ruskin School, Oxford. In 1882, he was introduced by Father George Congreve, Society of the St. John the Evangelist, to Charles Irma Kemp, a glass painter and church craftsman, who arranged for him to work voluntarily in his drawing office in London while continuing studies at the South Kensington School of Art. And this gave Comber the eye and skill to develop his vocabulary of workmanship and skill, and gave him the confidence to train workmen in many disciplines and imbue them with his standards and aesthetic ideals. And we need to understand that Comber would never get a job in today's world because he never went to university, he never got a degree in architecture. He learned his skills from the ground up. The kind of thing that architects might learn tangentially later on, he knew from the beginning. In 1883, he entered the drawing office of George Frederick Bodley as an articled pupil with a four-year indenture. Bodley and his partner Thomas Garner were the leading church architects of the day, whose work represented for Comber a standard of perfection unequalled by any other architect other than George Gilbert Scott Jr. In other words, the way you learned to be an architect in those days was you worked as a junior assistant in somebody's office. You learned by watching and doing, by giving small jobs and slowly being worked up into more complex tasks. In 1887, he was lodging with Father George Hollings, Society of St. John the Evangelist, the chaplain to the Sisters of Bethany. Watch again how Comber advances because of the contacts his father has made for him. He begins designing for the Order School of Embroidery, a lifelong association, as he takes over direction of the school, as this school comes to produce the finest vestments, banners, altar frontals, and linen in Britain. It was unequalled and came to exercise a strong influence on church embroidery and ecclesiastical taste. And now he's got another skill under his belt. Now I regret we were looking for the wonderful Russian cloth of gold coat that he made later on at Norwich Cathedral. We couldn't find that. Together with a little mitre, apparently the Dean of Norwich Cathedral is the only person in the Church of England who's allowed to wear a mitre who isn't a bishop, because in legal precedent, his predecessor as the abbot of Norfolk Abbey was entitled to wear a mitre. But this will just have to do. I must say the Delmatic there is rather over the top, with those rather highly OTT things of Our Lady. And it's a pretty straightforward coat. In 1887, Comber goes out on his own, and in 1888 teams up with William Bucknell, a finisher for another architecture office. Now a finisher is somebody who attached to your staff. You do the broad design, the grand design, this, but give the finishing details to this member of your staff. Bucknell was a good draftsman, a sound constructor, but a pedestrian architect. Yet in collaboration with Compass Artistry, the buildings produced where structure complements detail. At the age of 24, in 1890, Compa marries Bucknell's sister Grace. Later on, their partnership splits, but the Bucknell family comes to be deeply intertwined in the affairs of the practice. Now, I need a little note here on the dominant way that Compa thinks about doing this work: unity by exclusion. Compa believed at this stage very much in Gothic architecture, and he was greatly impressed by this church of St. Lawrence Nuremberg in southern Germany, which had been built between 1445 and 1472, what he called the Northern Renaissance as a dominant image. So, in other words, what I'm going to do is just exclude every other style except the Northern Gothic, and I'm going to implement this in terms of the English use. This is the rood screen at St. Peter's Ely in Cambridgeshire, which he created in 1889. Now, many of Compa's works are restorations, redecoration of medieval interiors. This was his first rood screen. The rood screen is the visual centerpiece of every medieval parish church, with the high altar at its heart. It divided the ritual enclosure of the chancel from the nave, and took its name from the crucifix. Very common, just painted up there. For the figures of St. Mary and St. John, which stood upon or above the loft. Compass rood screens were easy to look through and sometimes designed lightly to enable the worshipper to see the high altar. Sorry about that. It's conceived as a window frame through which the congregation watched the principal masses and the most important elements of the liturgy, and were decorated with complex iconography that emphasized Catholic doctrine and the heavenly hierarchy. There are instances in Compa's work of lofts incorporating musicians' galleries, organs, and even chapels. We'll see all of that. The screens all had a liturgical function and were never simply ornamental. Compa believed that, quote, an English parish church without a screen may be said to have ceased to be English almost as much as an Eastern church without an iconostasis. This was commissioned by Dr. Salisbury James Murray Price, who was described as a well-connected man of being with, quote, an ultra-sacerdotalist medievalist. And he will introduce Compa to some of his most important clients, and his patronage and introductions are decisive for Compa's future as an architect. This is his next major job, St. Wilfrid's Cantley in South Yorkshire, and this was done between 1893 and 1894. It's the second restoration of a medieval church. The choir was moved out of the chancel, back to the west end of the church, to free up the sanctuary for Eucharistic worship in the offices. Now, this is a characteristic hallmark of Compa's work. Try and get as much space as you can in the sanctuary. Don't let it be cluttered. His first Gothic altar, remember, this is what Percy Dermer was pushing last week, of stone, standing free from the west wall, it's not up against the wall at all, modelled on medieval illuminations. It had four riddle posts, these things here, hung with curtains suspended by silk cords, looped in split rings, running on black iron rods. The posts supported gilded figures of kneeling angels holding tapers. The altar's backed by a low reredos, of carved, coloured, and gilded, with two candlesticks, and that's Percy Dillon's recommendation. The altar is covered by embroidered panel frontal and narrow frontlet. There's an overhanging canopy or tester. This is another hallmark of Compa's work. Usually you get testers above pulpits, but he always liked to put them above altars. They're always gorgeously decorated, because it makes the sound. See, the celebrant east facing east, that helps with that, but it also helps to focus on the altar. Above the altar is a hanging pyx for reservation. Compa preferred this method of reservation, but it didn't take hold as a general method because it was considered too unsafe. Gothic altars later became ubiquitous in the Church of England thanks to Dermer's Parson's Handbook. Let me just say a bit more about the pyx. In other words, this sacrament's up here, and the priest will have some kind of, chain, or he can lower it down to remove the sacrament from. And it's, everybody's administered, it's very much part of the serum use as well. Oh, this is beautiful statue that's there at Public Church too. The incumbent did a thorough job, everything was done. And these beautiful carved and painted statues go with the package as well. This is All Saints St. Ives, Huntingdonshire, back in Cambridgeshire, which was done between 1894 and 1899. The rector gave Comp a free hand to restore the church, and the main interest is the organ screen, one of Comp's most elaborate early designs, and that's modelled on King's College, Cambridge. Now, what's unusual is that usually Comp does his organ screens at the west end of the church. Here it's at the east end, and you could put a choir here, you can walk along here, not just for the organs to get there. And here's the Christ crucified with Mary and John on either side. So it's very unusual to have this at the west end by the high altar. Probably he's done the statues as well. Right, we are now at Downside Abbey in Somerset, a very famous Roman Catholic community in the West Country, where he worked on this from 1896 onwards. It's the only commission he got from the Roman Catholic Church. It's one of the outstanding churches of the Gothic Revival, which had been worked on at different times by four of the major Gothic Revival architects. Comp was brought in at a late stage to do the Lady Chapel here, because the priest who had engaged his services to do the church in Huntingdonshire has now poked it and has now become a monk at Downside, and he persuades the community to let Comp do this piece of work. It's one of Comp's finest Gothic altars, and described as a striking novelty. He also did the stained glass window in the chapel, and it's a remarkable feature. Typical English glass with this mysterious effect of liquid silvery coolness as of light seen through water. This is Comp's definition of a dim religious light. He came to use medieval recipes in which sand and seaweed were used as a flux, made in clay pots instead of modern chemical methods used in metal pots. The chapel is one of the finest works of religious art of the early 20th century. It opened a vision of the medieval past, obscured by later Puritan severity and crude Victorian restoration. And Comp's complete sympathy with Downside encourages his ecumenical hopes for the union of the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church, though he was never a papalist. However, he did not like benediction, that's to say, the Blessed Sacrament's laid around as a blessing, nor did he like relics. We lost that image. Now we're at St. Mary Magdalene, Paddington, in London, and it's the Chapel of St. Sepulchre, done in 1895. Now, this was a memorial to Father West, the first vicar of this church, and a well-known ritualist, and they rather feared that perhaps the Diocese of London, under its new Protestant bishop, would try to take away the right to reserve a sacrament. So, remember, those of you who've watched my John Betjeman film to recall, this was shown there, and just this sacrament is concealed just here. It's cunning that you can actually tilt it sideways to reveal where the sacrament's reserved. And for those of you who are Inspector Adam Dalgleish fans, this church, or above it, was used to shoot the episode, which I think it gets murdered towards the end. And so this is in the basement, and it's near a canal. We'll talk about that later on. He transformed the south aisle streets, severe and monumental crypt, into a late medieval votive shrine and chantry chapel, using controlled delicacy and sweetness of effect to counteract the crushing context. The vault was given an impression of infinity by being painted dark blue with stars of gilded lead. When candles were lit at night, the vault was transformed into a sparkling firmament representing the vault of heaven. The function of the chapel was not solely that of a chantry, but also a place of reservation of the Blessed Sacrament. Comp later came to regret this piece of work as a slavish example of bad copies of bad German figures, to quote him. Yet it remains a consummate example of Comp's early church design. Now, the problem with being near the canal is that there's been a persistent damp problem. And that wonderful blue paint has just peeled off. And one guy was brought in at a later stage of the 20th century to repaint it. And he said, by the time I turned back, the blood started, had already begun. He said, the damn effect going already. So it was not a wise place to have created this kind of effect. John Betjeman used to take people here in this cult of Compass, which we'll be hearing about later, as one of the places to enthuse them about Compass work. This is St. Mary Eggmanton in Nottinghamshire. It's a restoration job done in 1897. The most beautiful and complete of Compass many restorations. Beautifully proportioned, the screen is based on Norfolk precedents, the organ on German examples. Look at these lovely images of the saints here. Remember that film I showed you last year about various churches around Norfolk, and the church at Ranworth has those paintings, one of the side chapels that was used for women who were praying for safety of their children. Notice the tester here. I think, can't quite work it out. I don't think the tester's above the altar. I think it looks as though it's above the screen here. Is the rood. There is, so you see, it's actually a small church. It's just in his main door with the organ case above it. You come in to face the font and then turn around, and there's the screen. In 1902, Compa finally gets a chance to do his own church. This is St. Cyprian Clarence Gate in Marylebone, London. If you're in Baker Street, don't get sidetracked into Madame Tussauds at Waxworth. Keep going and find this wonderful church, which looks quite unprepossessing from the outside. It was built between 1902 and 1903. The expression summing up all one had learned so far. The promoters wanted to build a quintessential Anglican church for the 20th century in which the principles of the Oxford movement would be realised in an English form free from continental influence. The wall churches of East Anglia informed the plan, furniture and form, also influenced by the small basilican churches in Rome. What I mean by the wall churches of East Anglia is that East Anglia went through a period of great prosperity in the Middle Ages out of the wall trade, and these vast churches, wonderfully decorated, were created, that have been somewhat left behind by history, and the tall ceilings on one side of that. A simple red brick exterior gives no impression of the beauty and surprise of the interior. It is a fusion of control, austerity, and splendour. Austerity created by the wide spacing and severe detail of the arcades. The simple unworked mouldings, the white walls, and wide windows with web-like tracery filled to the aisles with bottle-end glass. Splendour in the gilded and painted delicacy of the screens, we're right across the church here, stretching for the entire width of the church, with a loft, rood, and figures of St. Mary and St. John and winged seraphim. This is a tester, and now this is another hallmark of Compass work, Christ in glory. But instead of a stern, judging Christ, he's a beautiful Christ in victory. The sanctuary levels were kept low. Oh, sorry. The open chancel screen, the transparency of which is completed by the great windows behind it. The low down east window and those which light the altar from the sides make the whole church a lantern, and the altar is the flame within it. For Compa, liturgy predetermines architecture, and the whole point of it is that the altar is the centerpiece. Everything must revolve around that. The sanctuary levels were kept low. The altar is at eye level, visible to the whole body of worshippers, and the single row of choir stalls on either side of the chancel left a wide space for ceremonial and an unobstructed view. The figures on the rood were executed with wonderful majesty. They followed the classical dignity and structure of Greco-Roman and early Christian sculpture by representing triumph rather than suffering. Here's a description of the opening ceremony that really went to town. At the consecration, the rite was based upon the pontifical of Egbert, Archbishop of York, in 766. Does it embody the real, true ceremony of the Old Church of England? Musicians supplemented by the Nuns Choir of St. Catherine's Convent, Queen Square, Holborn, sang plain song in voices of exceptional sweetness under the direction of the Reverend G.H. Palmer, who they recall as the music director of Fizzy Dinner when he first got to St. Mary's from Rose Hill. The nave was strewn with branches of pine, box and rose petals, and the chancel with crimson roses and white lilies. Think of doing that. Bishop Binnington Ingram wore Combe's magnificent coat of Russian cloth of gold, which the Bishop of Norwich wore at the coronation of Edward VII, and a jewelled mitre. Gold cloaks for the cantors, embroidered by the Sisters of Bethany, were lent from St. Mark's Philadelphia and All Souls Brighton, and the red silk tunicles from St. Mary Magdalene's Paddington. Candles were lit before the 12 consecration crosses on the pillars of the nave to represent the 12 apostles. And while I'm quoting, Comper, you may recall, got stuck into Percy Durham and had a lifelong conflict. This is what he said. Those extreme things for which the fight was hard, and often against honest opponents who really believed that the doctrines of which they were the expression were false, are now accepted by the bishops and adopted by an ever-increasing number of churches, which attach to them no more than their aesthetic value. Mere ritualism has become either popular or a matter of indifference. The chasuble for which Father S.F. Green was imprisoned for 2 years without prospect of release is now worn even by the archbishops on occasions in which will give no offence. There is little doctrinal significance and little liturgical appreciation behind it, and little regard for the authority of the church or for more than personal preference. And that's a prophecy which has become true. Clergy became more invested because it looked nice, because it represented the doctrine of Eucharist and sacrifice. So, the furniture and painted glass of this church took many years to complete and continued until the end of Comper's life. During this time, Comper radically changed his mind about medievalism's exclusive claim to Northern Gothic. The Mediterranean scheme of colour, the pale lemon tone of the gilding, the star-spangled grey tone of blue in the screen's imagery, the masses of blue, softer and purpler in the tester. And that's up there. The emerald green are taken from the 16th century coffered ceilings of the Roman basilicas and the broad masses of colour in the 11th century mosaic churches of Palermo. Now, Comper wanted the churches, the chairs in this church removed after every service to create what he called an enveloping atmosphere of prayer. I think this photograph makes quite a lot of those chairs look good. In 1904, the partnership of Comper and Bucknell was dissolved because of Bucknell's inefficiencies on a major project when he was discovered drunk on site. However, other Bucknells came to the firm. Now, Comper believes in unity by inclusion. In 1900, two events occurred that challenged Comper's conviction of the supremacy of English and Northern European late Gothic art. The first was the purchase of Essay on the History of English Church Architecture Prior to the Separation of England from the Roman Obedience by George Gilbert Scott Jr. The second occasion was a first reluctant visit to Rome, also visits to three churches in Palermo and to churches on the Dalmatian coast, probably now called Yugoslavia. He saw a fusion of styles that impressed him. His early medievalist vision, inspired by Nuremberg, was transformed by the light and colour of the south and took him to fresh ideals of diverse and far-reaching influence and away from unity by exclusion, his first aesthetic ideal. He felt that now one must take account of the design of Christian churches from the beginning, their basilican beginnings in Rome, and accept that liturgy predetermines church architecture and proceed by organic development. He couldn't say, in other words, that true Christian architecture began and ended with Northern European Gothic. What do I mean by basilican churchyard? When Christianity comes out into the open, because the Emperor Constantine makes us the official religion of the Roman Empire. Remember, Christians had worship mainly in house churches for the first 400 years. Well, they now need big public buildings, and the basilica was the building, the main administrative building, where the leading administrative official of the Roman Empire would conduct major ceremonies, would receive the emperor, would conduct places of judgment. These were now taken over as places of Christian worship, and they've had a major influence on what churches look like now. Here we have St. Giles Wimborne in Dorset, a restoration and refurbishment after fire and was consecrated in 1910. By now, Compass practice has expanded, taking on new staff and shifting premises, including his son Sebastian and significantly Martin Travers as one of the finishers. St Giles was the first application of the theory of unity by inclusion. The result looks like a church that has evolved naturally through time. It retains a quintessential English quality, but one that is far from insular. Comper became impatient with a sterile promotion of Englishness because he knew it was historically false, quoting him now. Shallow and narrow is the cry, study and copy only what is English. Why, the best and most characteristic of what is English was brought from abroad by just such English travellers and crusaders, not to mention the Italians and Frenchmen who took up their abode with us. It is the way in which it is used and made one with the England of God's creation that matters. Mere imitation is worthless. It must be vitalised and made distinctive of the country of its adoption. So we can see that you can see the altar highlighted clearly through the screen. This is St John the Baptist Lounge in Suffolk. It's an organ case screen and other work done between 1909 and 1914. Father Booth Lyons had moved to Lowndes from London in 1908 and spent most of his fortune restoring the church to its medieval arrangements. In those days, there was no parochial church council, couldn't have better stopped you, you just go for it, and this ancestral court stopped you in your tracks. Comper had observed that many medieval churches were little more than barns, and this was true of Lowndes. In other words, if you look at this building apart from that, it's just, you know, white walls and a very simple building. So, gilded and painted, the organ case rose to the roof. Comper regarded this as the most successful case he had designed. He's very keen on organ cases. He was much happier with the west end rather than the east end. To satisfy the screen, he thought it was a failure, though the loft was too low for the proportions of the church. Many think this is Comper's best work of redecoration. And I think that the font, the medieval font, it's a very small parish church. I think you can look at this in October. So we're staying with a curate at Great Yarmouth, just 12 miles away from here. Now, this is St. Mary Wardleworth in Rochdale, Lancashire, built between 1904 and 1912. Unfortunately, we can't get an image of the major part of the interior of the church. It replaced a mean 18th century building or difficult site. The east window position was planned to bring it into the only open space between cotton mills. It followed the building of St. Mary's Wellingborough, but lacked St. Mary's Wellingborough's spectacular qualities. But architecture is more interesting, because Comper had to think hard about the plan. Now, you're looking here at the long Gothic altar hung with rose, red sedges and red season. The difference between all other Comper altars, to the north and south, is a wide division between the riddle curtains and the altar. Remember David Hoskins was talking about our old friend Bishop Knox of Manchester, the Evangelical, last week. And he insisted that there be space at the corners for the north end celebration of the Eucharist. In other words, classic hardline conservative evangelicals might have actually seen this in my lifetime, following what they saw to be the rubrics of the prayer book, would celebrate at the north end here. Because, you see, when the Reformation came and the clergy was ordered to stop celebrating the way medieval mass priests had, the first thing the Cranmer wanted to stop doing was celebrating from the eastward position, because this emphasised the sense of mystery. So if the vicar moved to the north end, it became very clear what was happening in terms of the manual acts, which were reduced to a minimum. And this was designed to reduce or remove any suggestion of the doctrine of transubstantiation of a real change in the bread and wine. Evangelical clergy did this, but also they refused to use wafer breads, and they used a sliced piece of bread, and they'd get a knife and they'd slice it up top and down, so they'd just break it off easily to get their real bread. Comper continued working on the church until 1937. He was cool and unenthusiastic about it because of its conventional church life, so far from his Anglo-Catholic religious convictions and development. Here's one of my favourites. This is Wyndham Abbey in Norfolk. This image fails to convey the absolutely staggering impact it makes on you as you meet at this church. This was a medieval abbey church. One part was not used. There had been a lot of conflict between the townsfolk and the monks. after the Reformation, this main part of the building continued to be used as the parish church. This would be, this Ruredos would be higher than the west end of St. Peter's. So when you enter this church, it's just a staggering impact on you, brings you to your knees. This was done between 1913 and 1934. Conker designed a great screen of tabernacle work and decorated wood, which was materials consistent with the East Anglian tradition. The inspiration was the high altar of Westminster Abbey. There is a large canopy over the screen. Decorated with trumpeting angels and the gifts of the Holy Spirit radiating from a dove. The screen has two tiers of nine tabernacles, and three of those in the upper tier are over a central figure of the Majestas, which on a considerably larger scale than the other figures occupies the middle of the tiers of statuary. Over that, upon a beam one day of the clerestory westwards are the rood and winged cherubim. We can't actually see them, so this is so big. This design is subordinate to the Majestas, which dominates the nave, which is the focal point in the centre of the church. Now, this symbolism represents Christ in judgment as presented in Revelation chapter 4, verses 1 to 2. It was dedicated in 1921, but the decoration of the tabernacle work in burnished gold and Mediterranean colour was not completed until 1934. The Wyndham of the screen is the largest and most beautiful English screen erected in the 20th century, surpassing all others. It anticipates Graham Sutherland's monumental tapestry at the east end of Coventry Cathedral, but it's unfinished and does not represent Conker's full intentions. He hated and thought very unsatisfactory the Edwardian pavement here, and he felt that the sanctuary level had raised the altar too high, nor was he allowed to hang a pyx to reserve the Blessed Sacrament. Conker wanted to create a vision of heaven. The screen illustrates the density of sculptural richness and colour, the finesse of workmanship, the classical structure of the tall images, their elusive movement, the elegantly disposed drapery of the figures in flowing but restrained folds, and the play of light on gilded surfaces. You know anything about the ritualist movement? You know that Father Arthur Stanton from London was one of the great heroes of the early 20th century, a great preacher, very theatrical. He was Conker's confessor, and so he designed a Chantry Chapel for him in the church in Central London, which was destroyed by World War II bombing. Conker's best work was done between 1904 and 1914. After the war, architects had to face reduced economic circumstances, and there were fewer opportunities for work with the same scope. The majority of Conker's lavish post-war commissions had been given before the war started, and were, with a handful of notable exceptions, the completion of existing work. By a strange irony, although three of Conker's sons and all his young assistants fought in the war, none were killed, and the same standard of workmanship was continued in the post-war record period. Now, there was a brief boom in Conker's practice, of course, all memorials were created immediately after the First World War, so about 3 or 4 years after the war, it got to work that way. Here we have Southwark Cathedral. The Diocese of Southwark was created in the early part of the 20th century, carving off a large part of the Diocese of Rochester and some of London. It was very short of money, and Conker did the work on the altar around there. And quite a bit of other restoration with other pockets of it, much of which had been swept away by the reformed work of another architect and another dean. Right, this is one of my favourites, which I have never seen and probably never will see. The Society of All Saints, London Colney in Hertfordshire, a conventual chapel built between 1921 and 1928, completed by Sebastian Conker, his son, between 1960 and 1964. All Saints Convent had an orphanage and a hospital attached to it. The church was designed to be strictly conventual. In other words, it's these wide side bays here that are open, though not obvious from the west end. Primarily to give privacy to a large choir, but it was also planned to meet the needs of visual participation in the worship at the high altar of the other residents of the convent besides the nuns and their visitors, and in particular of children. The high altar was placed on a crossing beneath a gilded ciborium. That's this thing here. The pillars decorated with flowers and a crocketed ogee crown at 8 arches. You see that better. It is the all-dominating element enclosed within white walls. The plan enables worshippers on all sides to have complete visibility. It was based on what is in Tavesti, in what we now call Algeria, and a church had seen in Avignon, dating back to the Avignon papacy. Now, the point is this. Pompey had solved a problem that the liturgical movement would have to solve in the post-World War II period. And it was commonly solved by pushing the altar forward, so the vicar celebrates behind the altar facing westward. What Pompey had done was to move the altar forward a bit, put this wonderful ciborium or canopy over it to give it central focus. But worshippers were on three sides. There. Now, there's something odd about this image, which makes me wonder if this is the same place, because, of course, in Pompey's original creation, there's none of these wooden screens to the side, that they're over the conventual chapels open. I'm wondering, this was sold to the All Saints Convent, fell back on Oxford, they sold it to the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Westminster, who turned it into the All Saints Pastoral Centre, and I'm wondering if they did this, or is it another work very close to it? But anyway, the appointment, we'll see this in Philip's Caution. And this, you know, when altars were first pushed westward and clergy began celebrating behind it, in some cases with violence to churches where the whole focus had been on the westward, besides, Magdalene is an arch example. If you look at it, the stage that goes up, and now they've pushed it. What is it? The whole church only makes sense if you've got an altar up on that stage and the priest celebrating eastward. This was a way of solving the problem. The vicar would still be celebrating eastward, but people could participate and worship them around. Tragically, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Westminster has now sold this beautiful church to a developer. And the wonderful ciborium was already looking pretty tacky, and I doubt whether it will survive its new owner. And even if you removed the ciborium and the altar and put it somewhere else, it just would look wrong, I think. This is St. Philip's Cosham in Portsmouth, on the outskirts of Portsmouth. I actually went here 3 years ago. You can get there on a train line quite easily. And it was built between 1935 and 1939. Again, it's a completely unremarkable exterior. You wouldn't think this. It's based in an interwar housing estate, which is now relatively prosperous, but clearly few other people go there to church. It was the only new parish church where Pompey was able to apply the planning theories with which he experimented at London Colney. The ciborium is decorated in burnished gold and complete in its imagery with the figure of the risen saviour surmounting it. Between four eagles at the corners from whose beaks lamps are suspended. The ceiling is painted as a firmament in blue and gold. Remember, I think the seven gifts of the Spirit are shown inside the canopy as you look up. A silver crucifix with figures of St. Mary and St. Joseph stands upon the altar between four candlesticks. Heartbreakingly, the present woman priest there has removed two of the candlesticks and that beautiful silver crucifix which she's celebrating facing westward, which is mad. It was never designed to do that. Pompey himself gave the Magistas. Now that's, I think it's in the window. In the painted glass, the tracery of the east window. The font cover is decorated in burnished gold and colour, and so is the organ case, which is just above it. The walls, classical columns on their severe and beautiful Corinthian capitals modelled on the North African crescents and plaster vaults are lime washed. The altar is in every sense the centre and richest part of the church. So again, you know, this is the whole point. It brings you to your knees as soon as you enter the building. It's the, you know, the lantern, isn't it, in effect? Flames out. St. Philip realised all that Pompey advocated in planning our modern church. It is his legacy to the future. It was the fulfillment of his quest for beauty and liturgical planning on rational principles. A church that was essentially modern, yet indebted to the unfolding development of the Catholic tradition as it had evolved from Constantine to the 20th century, in which the heart and purpose of worship was the gathering of the baptized and the offering of the Mass. St. Philip's led to a revival of interest in Pompey's work, especially among the young. few immediately understood as overriding preoccupation for the setting, position, appearance, and significance of the altar, but John Betjeman and John Piper were persuaded. One reason for the cult of Compa they started was his later work, with burnished gold, ciboria, and an austere and light architectural setting corresponded with contemporary taste. And not was this earlier, intense, and highly decorated medievalism was interpreted as a manifestation of English Romanticism. This is Pusey House, Oxford, that we talked about in preceding lectures, and he was asked to do a chapel for resurrection, and he did the support and other furnishings between 1935 and 1939. The commission for the Chapel of the Resurrection at Pusey House came as a result of a substantial legacy from a Lady Pell who wanted to create, quote, an Anglo-Catholic object. This was a controversial project because the Jerome poverty marches had just come to Oxford, and many undergraduates thought it was inappropriate to be spending that sort of money on this sort of a project at that particular time. The Pusey House Ciborium was the most finished of those that preceded it. His inspiration was a Renaissance ciborium designed for the chapel of King Henry VII in Westminster Abbey. Compa continued to design ciboriums the rest of his life, but not generally adopted by the Church of England, because it was thought exotic and expensive. But principally this opposition from Dr. Eales, who had lived with Percy Dearmer's vicarage and had gone on to become, from a shy Scotsman, the secretary of the Central Council for the Care of Churches. And he thought, he'd taken a downer on Compa's work, he thought this was based on inspiration from Compton, and we didn't want that in England. So this respectively gleams within Temple Moore's blackened stone walls. It made a profound impression on many, and John Betjeman would take people to see it in order to promote Compton's cause. The altar and ciborium was the most signal church finishing scheme of Compton's maturity and equals the scale of its achievement before the Great War. This is All Saints Car Shulton in Surrey, where he did the furnishings, including the organ case, between 1920 and 1958. Compa liked Father Corbould, the vicar, and regularly worshipped at All Saints since he lived nearby. Corbould was an advanced Anglo-Catholic, a papalist, in other words, he believed the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church would be unified under the Pope as the Patriarch of the Western Church. And although Compa was impatient with the slavish imitation of Rome that excluded other strands of the Church's historic tradition, and what he dismissively dismissed as the cult of the Beretta, All Saints represented his own religious position at the end of his life. The ceremonies of the Mass were conducted with fastidious perfection, and the music was confined to plain song, Spanish and Italian polyphony, performed with finished artistry. Although Corbould and Compa shared the desire for a union of the Church of England with the Roman Catholic Church. Now, Compa took the existing screen that was there and added a loft and a majestas. So that, this, and this, and the pentopter. Again, another sign of his work. An image of beauty, not of suffering, or just stern judgment, but of victory. But his most splendid work at Car Shulton is the organ case and gallery at the west end of the church. Compa was 70 in 1934. During the next 10 years, his work was something of a new birth. Grace Compa's wife had died in 1933. She was his rock. They had a happy marriage and six children, but Compa put his work before his family, and thereafter he was able to apply himself with undivided attention and great freedom. There were also new patrons. He was sought by the young, and then in 1937 John Betjeman discovered him, and his infectious enthusiasm, extravagant praise and flattery did more than anything to give Compa new confidence. An unrestrained delight with decorative carving and his conversion to burnished gold infused his work with fresh life and vitality. The Car Shulton organ case embodies this new confidence, his largest and most complicated design. The organ stands in a gallery supported by a Tuscan columns that also makes them an affix to a name. In the spandrels, athletic nude angels, modelled from life, play musical instruments, and on the gallery front, medallions of angels and closed arabesques flank a chair case, which is alive with carved cherubs, volutes, and other arabesques. Now, this has been criticised by organ builders and purist organ scholars because it bears little relation to the actual organ, and is in fact a screen concealing the real organ. Compa thought some of his best work had been done at Car Shulton, though he considered that the project overall the church lacked unity. In 1947, Compa undergoes a profound spiritual crisis. This was the year of the creation of the Church of South India, which phased and integrated into existence an ecumenical church, you know, the Anglican component with bishops and free churches without bishops, which eventually became a combined ecumenical creation. For many Anglo-Catholics, this was the wrong kind of ecumenism because it appeared to be doing violence to the principle of the apostolic succession. Cotter almost converted to Rome, but he was persuaded against it by the Bucknells, who said that they would be ruined as it would bring the architectural practice to an end once the word got out of his conversion. Thereafter, Cotter maintained a public Anglican face with an uneasy interior disposition, combined worship at All Saints Kaishalpan with the Brompton Oratory. In 1950, he receives a knighthood at the age of 86. By now, the practice is in decline. He refuses to retain his son Sebastian, although he did not have his father's spark, had a successful practice, and went on to design, rebuild, and furnish many Anglican and Roman Catholic churches. He'd been trained in his father's principles, and together they might have enabled Compass post-war restorations to be executed. The young Compass thought they'd been superseded in his affections by the Bucknells, who had now thoroughly infiltrated the practice. Many of Compass' craftsmen had died, retired, or left, and so the work of the practice deteriorated and became progressively repetitive. Cotter died in 1960. His ashes were buried not where he wished, it was the Mac Grace and Arthur Bucknell in the Jesus Chancel at Wellingborough, but at Dean Abbott's invitation in the north aisle of Westminster Abbey, nearby the other great Victorian ecclesiastical architects. We're now going to look at what's considered the greatest creation, and this is St. Mary's Wellingborough in Northamptonshire. This church was built from 1904 onwards and was called the Triumph of Unity by Inclusion. Now, Wellingborough is what's called a boot and shoe town. The way to think of the Diocese of Peterborough is like sausage, with Northampton at one end and Peterborough at the other. And in between were these boot and shoe towns where, you know, Clark's shoes used to be very much the end to it. They were very close to it. In fact, this is an unusual shop. The church is scrunched up against these workers' terrace cottages. Three wealthy Anglo-Catholic spinsters had given money for a mission church in Wellingborough. Cotter got the commission on the advice of their spiritual director. Our Father Watts was appointed the mission priest while the church hadn't been built, and he expected a medievalist Gothic church whose design would not go beyond the 14th and the 15th centuries. A strained relationship developed as Cotter's revolution in taste and approach to unity by inclusion took him by surprise. There were tense relationships between him and Cotter, who twice offered to resign. Henriette Sharman, one of the spinsters, adjudicated in the rows and backed Cotter because of his powers of persuasion and their shared delight in foreign travel and European culture, so sisters decided to support him. It took 26 years to build. This is no superficial theatrical stage set with spectacular services, like the work of Cotter's imitators and his former assistant Martin Travers. The church is built for the liturgy in its pristine purity, nothing else. For Cotter, the Mass is the meeting place of earth and heaven. St. Mary's is a vessel for the Eucharist, and all within and surrounding it take their heightening from it. It was Cotter's favourite work because it was there in a relatively unfettered context that he was able to achieve all he wanted to do. It was a laboratory for his art in the same way as early restorations in churches have been. Cotter was heavenly minded in a way that's become inaccessible to modern thought. He believed the church should pray of itself with its architecture. It is its own prayer and should bring you to your knees when you enter. He saw St. Mary's not solely as a work of art, but as an expression of beauty and unity, reflected the beauty and unity of the Holy Trinity, and was a foretaste of the eternal beauty of heaven. Let's look at the characteristic things here. Here's the pantocrator, forward where it usually is. Here's the rood screen. Here's the loft. You can walk along here if you wanted to. Here's the screen, but open enough to easily see the altar. This screen runs across to here, and like St. Cyprian's Clarence Goat doesn't go there. Quite a big church. Not as much natural light though as St. Cyprian's Clarence Goat. When I was here at the Northampton, I went to a meeting of SSC, Extreme Anglo-Catholic Priest Society. The church was going through a bad time with an elderly priest, not many people going. West Indian church using the basement as a major source of income. I think it's undergone something of a revival just lately. It's a falling faith parish and attracts people of that persuasion from across the land. You should be doing much better. So, John Letchman had become the major promoter of COMPA, and this was an ambivalent advocacy. He promoted COMPA as a modernist, a movement which COMPA loathed. While publicly praising COMPA, he often used his gift of mimicry, shafts, and mockery behind his back and called him synonymy pimony. It was a double-edged nature of support. His campaign to obtain a knighthood for him was undertaken as much to annoy the Royal Institute of British Architects as to achieve a belated recognition. After all, COMPA didn't have a qualification. He wasn't an architect. He was theoretically operating illegally. But this was well in the eye of the Institute of Architects. Some of the suspended dinner given in the Athenaeum for his 90th birthday, although sprinkled with Duke and Earl, deans, canons, and church architects, the beau monde, and some of COMPA's family and pupils quietly in their midst, was offstage among his friends, presented by Betjeman as a huge joke. Betjeman's perverse empathy with the unfashionable, that he loved to make mischief, to tease, and to shock, in a sense, his sponsor of the Victorian architecture being to deliberately out to outrage certain canons of established taste. He used COMPA to tease and provoke Nicholas Pevsner, who wrote the famous guidebooks, who retaliated by damning COMPA's work as influential guides, doing lasting damage to COMPA's reputation. His friendship with COMPA exposed the complexity and contradictions of his character. He found COMPA funny and laughed at him, but he was enchanted by his company and charm, had genuine affection for him, and treated him with generosity and kindness. COMPA had touching confidence in him and was unaware of the mockery behind his back. On the other hand, Betjeman shared COMPA's religious convictions. He recognised him as an artist. He found work for him, and his sympathetic attention enabled his genius to flower. He helped to give COMPA an interesting and happy old age. And you know, how do I know about Lenin COMPA? Because I read this book by John Betjeman called First and Last Loves when I was in my late teens. And there's three pages on St. Cyprian's Clarence Gate and St. Philip's Caution that began to get me interested in this person. So Betjeman did a great work of promoting what had been very worthwhile things. Whenever I go to Cornwall, I use this book as my guide because it was what's worth going to see. So finally, what is the significance of Ninian COMPA? He argued that the architecture he did and which he wished to see was not the Gothic revival, but taking Gothic on from its arrested development in an authentic and organic process of development. He argued that the liturgy predetermines architecture. The altar is the lantern that lights up the church as the central focus. He eschewed empty aestheticism, which is why he quarreled with Percy Durman. We don't do this the dressing up of creators of beautiful structure. It's there to do a job of work in the liturgy. He was a true believer in the principles of Anglo-Catholicism. But intriguingly, he was only allowed to create three churches in their entirety, St. Philip's Caution, St. Cyprian's Clarence Gate, and St. Mary's Manager. And one of the great might have been is what might have been if he'd been given permissions to do many more churches, instead of mostly redecorating medieval interiors. His unity by inclusion was a pastiche mixture of different elements, but true to the development of churches from the Constantinian era to create churches with light, colour, and spaciousness. It was a welcome move away from Gothic gloom. The plastic arts of embroidery, stained glass window making, carving, painting, vestment making was a sign of the Oxford movement's cultural creativity. And what he did was a welcome alternative to the brutal modernism of post-war churches. So in that sense, he's an intriguing alternative to what happened in the years after the Second World War.